At this time, we are going to collect an offering. And there's two ways to give. You can either give in one of the buckets that's about to be passed, or you can give on your smartphone at paradoxgiving.org. We just want to say thank you for all that you have given and all that you continue to give. And I'd like to invite you to turn in your Bibles to Habakkuk 2, please. Habakkuk 2. We're in a two-part series. This is part two of two in the book of Habakkuk, and we are studying this short book in the Bible that's only three chapters long, and we will be in Habakkuk chapter 2 today. So before we get there, though, before we read in Habakkuk chapter 2, I'd like to tell you about what we talked about last week, because we talked about the story of Habakkuk, and namely how Habakkuk is written in Judah, and there are three superpower nations surrounding Judah at this point. To the north, the red star is the Assyrians. To the south is the Cyan star, which is the Egyptians. And to the east is the orange star, which is the Babylonians. And it's absolutely imperative that when you read Habakkuk, that you understand that Habakkuk is written right here. And in 586 BCE, eventually this nation will come and crush the nation whose perspective this is being written from. And so you have this book, Habakkuk, that is written with its back against the wall. It's written sometime in the late 7th century BCE, and it's written right there. And the last week, what we talked about is how this prophet stood before God and said, "Why don't you answer prayers? Why don't you hear my call? Why aren't you there, God?" And we read through Habakkuk, all three chapters, and we realized that Habakkuk doesn't really offer a lot of answers. But in Habakkuk, there are two verses that really stand out because they are fascinating in what they teach us today. And so as we talk about Habakkuk, remember that Habakkuk is written here, but we are going to read two of those verses in context with five other verses total. And so I'd like for us to read Habakkuk 2, verses 1 to 5. It starts with Habakkuk lamenting against God. He says, "I will stand at my watchpost and station myself on the rampart. I will keep watch to see what God will say to me and what God will answer concerning my complaint." Now, this is where the Bible story takes a bit of a different turn from what we are used to, because in verse 2, we hear, "Then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision, Habakkuk. Make it plain on tablets so that a runner may read it, for there is still a vision for the appointed time. It speaks of the end and does not lie. If it seems to tarry, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." God then says, "Look at the proud. Their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith. Moreover," God continues, "moreover, wealth is treacherous. The arrogant do not endure. They open their throats wide as Sheol. Like death, they never have enough. They gather all nations for themselves and collect all peoples as their own." And in verse 4, God says these words to Habakkuk. He says, "Look at the proud. Their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by faith." Which raises an interesting question. What does it mean to live by faith? Now, as you can imagine, this question provokes a lot of different responses. In our sermon study group, there were seven of us, and all seven of us had a different answer for what it meant to live by faith. All of us had gone to church. All of us had gone to church throughout our lives. All of us had gone to the same church for a while. And yet, when it came to this question, we all had different understandings of what this meant. So I was curious about this. So online, I posted this same question. What does it mean to live by faith on Facebook? And I got over 10 responses. And the 10 responses were all very different. But when you look at what this means, what does it mean to live by faith? Institutional religion will typically come back at you with something like this. To live by faith means that when your personal relationship with God is the most important thing in your life. If you prioritize your personal relationship with God, then you are living by faith. That's the understanding of what it means to live by faith. And according to God, who speaks to Habakkuk in this passage, he says, "The righteous will live by their faith." So let's look at some people in Bible history that took their relationship with God very seriously, made it the priority, made it the most important thing, and see what they did. Let's start with Joshua. Now, Joshua was the conqueror who took over the nation of Israel after Moses' death. And Joshua was leading the children of Israel back into the promised land. But there's a problem, because there's people there. And God has promised this land to Israel, but there are people there. So Joshua takes this nation and says, God has given us this land. Let's go and defeat our enemies. And one of the first battles that Joshua encounters is a battle at Jericho. And Jericho has high walls all around it. And Joshua says these words as they're about to attack Jericho. He says, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Well, the children of Israel shout, the walls come down, and then everybody charges in for the slaughter of Jericho. And we read in the Bible, it says, so the people charged straight ahead into the city and captured it. Then they devoted the destruction to destruction by the edge of the sword all in the city, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys. At this point, you're reading this and you're saying to yourself, wait a second, they just killed children? Because I saw Star Wars Episode 3 and I know that's the way to the dark side. I know it. And so you read this and you say, that can't be right. Well, God will surely show up and say, hey, Joshua, we have a relationship. This is wrong. I'm against this. Clearly, slaughtering children is against my ways, right? But as you continue to read in Joshua 6, the last verse is verse 27, and we read, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. God doesn't condemn this behavior. God is with Joshua the entire way. Does anyone else see a problem here? Does anyone else notice that, wait a second, this can't quite be right? So then you think to yourself, okay, maybe Joshua's an anomaly. Because the most important thing is to prioritize your relationship with God. Maybe let's look at somebody else, someone like Solomon. Now, Solomon, we talked about last week, but it's too good to pass up again because Solomon in 1 Kings 3, we read about how he loved the Lord walking in the statutes of his father, David. And Solomon eventually talks to God later in a vision, just a few chapters later in 1 Kings 6. He talks back and forth with God. He has a relationship. And in that conversation, he asks God for wisdom. God grants him wisdom, and Solomon becomes a powerful ruler. When Solomon has power, when he has resources, he then commissions God's temple in order to pay back to God what God has given him. And they build God's temple, and there's chapters upon chapter about how they built this temple. And after the chapter is done, Solomon prays to God and says, will you bless us with your presence again? And God says, yes. God responds to Solomon and converses with him a second time in 1 Kings 9 when God says, I have heard your prayer and your plea which you made before me. I have consecrated this house, this temple that you have built and put my name there forever. And we hear this story, we say, oh, that's what living by faith is about right there. Is God gives Solomon wisdom. Solomon builds an empire, and then he gives all the credit to God, builds a temple saying, this is where our strength has come from. But if you look at this temple that's inlaid with gold, you have to ask the question, who paid for that? Not only that, but who built this temple? And it's almost like the narrator of 1 Kings understands your question because in that very same chapter where Solomon and God talk to each other, the narrator essentially says these words. He says, all the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, who were not of the people of Israel, their descendants who were still left in the land, whom the Israelites were unable to destroy completely, these Solomon conscripted for slave labor, and so they are to this day. Now, at this point, you say, wait a second, was God's temple built by slaves? Because that seems like a problem. And the narrator hears your concern again. And he says, oh, no, it's okay, because in 1 Kings 9:22, the very next verse, it says, but of the Israelites, Solomon made no slaves. So they weren't slaves of their own people, and slavery is really only a problem when you're enslaving your own people, right? Does anyone else see a problem here? Does anyone else notice, like, wait, you just said, God, that you put your name in that temple forever, and you saw that temple being built by slaves. And yet you're like, oh, this is so nice. This is wonderful. And Solomon and Joshua are these two, like, just like really, really popular people about faith and what faith looks like and what a relationship with God looks like. And if you were to ask them, do you have a relationship with God? They would both say, yes, I have a personal relationship with God. And you'd say, well, how do you know? And they say, well, I talk to him and he talks back. How about you? And you'd say, I don't know. And you say, well, what have you done with your relationship with God, Joshua? And Joshua would say, well, I murder children for fame. And Solomon, you say to Solomon, what did you do with your relationship with God? And Solomon would say, well, I enslaved human beings to save money. And at this point, you start asking the question, does anyone else see a problem here? Because look at the proud. It says their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith, Habakkuk says, or God says to Habakkuk. And we talk about what does it mean to live by faith? If it's a personal relationship, Joshua and Solomon had a personal relationship with God, and they did some horrendous evils. And the question is, does anyone else see a problem here? When you look at these stories, and specifically Joshua, and it says, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. There are two questions that arise. And the questions are this. Did God demand the murder of the children of Jericho? Because if God did, then I'm not sure I want to worship that God. Or was Joshua's faith hijacked by pride? Joshua wanted to be known as the most terrible, most fearful, most frightening conqueror in all the land. So when he attacked a city, he leveled it. And did Joshua say, and God tells me to do all of these things? Well, which one is it? If you think about it that way, and you realize that it emphasizes, and Joshua's fame was in all the land, you realize that when Habakkuk writes these words, and he says that God spoke to me, and he says, look at the proud, their spirit is not right in them. Would you describe Joshua's spirit as not right within him? Of course. He murdered children. And when you look at this, you realize that all of a sudden when we talk about what does it mean to live by faith, maybe to live by faith is to trust that pride doesn't run the show. Maybe that's what it means to live by faith. When you look at Solomon, look at his temple in which he built with slave labor, the question that we have is, did God put his name in a temple built by slaves? Or was Solomon's faith hijacked by greed? Wanting it to be more elaborate, wanting it to be bigger, wanting it to be better, did he want just more and more and more to the point that he enslaved people? And when you look at what God says to Habakkuk about faith and what it means to live by faith, God says, moreover, wealth is treacherous. The arrogant do not endure. They open their throats wide as Sheol. Like death, they never have enough. Maybe to live by faith means to trust that greed doesn't run the show. And so when we talk about what does it mean to live by faith, maybe it's to trust that greed and pride aren't actually what life is about. And we look at these two figures of biblical times and we say like, well, they were in the wrong, they had it all wrong, they had it all messed up. Good thing we're not like them at all anymore. And that was back then, and we've come so far in such a short little time. We've come so far and we're so beyond the faith of Joshua and Solomon. Are we? Because when you look at American history, you realize that there's a lot of these same sins coming up. Specifically, when it comes to the colonization of America, one of the first companies to settle in America was known as the Virginia Company. And the Virginia Company showed up and they created a charter to tell England what they were all about. And if you look at the charter, it says, according to its royal charter, the Virginia Company's chief objective was the conversion of the native peoples to Christianity rather than financial success. They were there on a mission trip, essentially. And so they get there and they say, we're there to convert people to Christianity. But while they're there, they keep expanding its borders. They keep making more money. They keep sending more things back to England. So the Native Americans go to them and they say, hey, could you stop expanding, please? We agreed you would be this big, and you guys are this big. And the Virginia Company said, oh, you're right. We're sorry. We won't expand anymore. And it kept expanding and kept expanding. And this eventually angered the Powhatan tribe to the point where they attacked them in 1622, what is known as the Jamestown Massacre. 347 people of the Virginia Company, about a fourth of its residents, were slaughtered that day. Now, at this point, you look at this and you say, oh my word, this is a horrible tragedy. And of course it is. But the people of Jamestown were incensed and they retaliated. And over the next 3 years, they killed over 2,000 Powhatan Native Americans. They killed over 2,000. In other words, for every person they killed on that day of the Jamestown Massacre, they launched attacks in the Jamestown's name, and they avenged essentially seven times over the deaths that were wronged on them on that day. Now, at this point, According to its royal charter, the Virginia Company's chief objective was the conversion of the native peoples rather than financial success. We're there for Christianity, right? Well, I don't know if you know what Christianity is based on, but it's based on the life of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ said a lot about vengeance and forgiveness, and namely the fact that you should never repay violence with more violence. And they were there, and they felt like they were there on God's call, and they were there for that. And the question became, did God demand vengeance seven times over? Or was the Virginians' faith hijacked by pride? Which one was it? Because it sounds like when you're going back and you're killing seven in revenge for one, it sure sounds like a sin of pride. Look, a few years later in American history, at one of the worst marks on American history and just one of the worst things that's ever happened, you talk about the slave trade that happened, you know, that went through this country for 300 years. And when you talk about the slave trade, you have to understand that there were a lot of churches and a lot of Christians that were living in America during this day and age. And these Christians and these churches would often preach sermons about how God had ordained slavery as a right. And anytime somebody raised an objection, they were persecuting you for your faith. Specifically, there was a man named Ebenezer Warren, who was a pastor of a church in Savannah, Georgia, and he said these words in a sermon in 1861. He said, "Slavery forms a vital element of the divine revelation to man. Its institution, regulation, and perpetuity constitute a part of the many of the books of the Bible." At which point I would say, "Have you read Exodus? Because the whole thing is about slaves being freed." And so Ebenezer Warren kept going, not Elizabeth Warren, that's very different. Although I've heard she does have Native American blood. That's a joke for a few of us. Ebenezer Warren, who was quite, not related. Both Christianity and slavery are from heaven. Both are blessings to humanity. Both are to be perpetuated to the end of time. And therefore, both have been protected and defended by God's omnipotent arm from the assaults, oppositions, and persecutions through which they have passed. Pastor Ebenezer Warren, a Christian who has the same book that we read today, owned other human beings and never saw the hypocrisy of that. In fact, his faith enabled his behavior to own and trade and sell another human being. And at that point, we have to ask the question, were slave owners persecuted for their devout faith? Was this actually what God wanted? Or was Ebenezer Warren's faith hijacked by greed? And when we read the words of Habakkuk and what he says God said to him, Habakkuk writes these words, which is, "Moreover, wealth is treacherous. The arrogant do not endure. They open their throats wide as Sheol. Like death, they never have enough." It almost feels like God is speaking directly to pastors who would defend the abhorrent sin of slavery. And so we look at these two different stories about the Virginia Company and slave owners, and we say, oh, well, that was back then. We've come so far since then, to which I would point you to a football team, specifically the Baylor Bears of Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Now, the Baylor Bears have come to national prominence recently because they are a Christian university. But in just a very short time, they went from one of the worst teams in football, in college football, to one of the best teams. In fact, in 1995, they had their last winning season until they hired this man, Art Briles, in November 28, 2007. They hired this man, and they said, "Can you turn this program around? We're terrible, we want to be a good football team, and we're tired of losing." So they hired Art Briles and said, "Why don't you turn this around?" So Art Briles said, "I'll do it." And so the first season, they lost a lot. Second season, they lost a lot. But then the third season, something changed. They hired a new president at Baylor, a man named Ken Starr. And if you're thinking this man looks a little bit familiar, the answer is yes. It's that Ken Starr who wrote the Starr Report detailing the Bill Clinton scandal, you know, in 1993. He was the president of this university, and he was hired in 2010 to turn the university around, essentially. And his motto, his whole understanding, his whole model was built on the success of athletics. And he said these words. He says, "Success in athletics means that all boats rise." In other words, if we got a good football team, more money will come into the university, and then we can spend that money on all the programs, And all of a sudden, everything gets better. If we're a better football team, Baylor University becomes a better university. And so they went through that, and they said, let's do this. And so they started recruiting. They started giving more and more funding to football. And they said, we can build a really good team here in Baylor. And eventually they recruited a man named Robert Griffin III, who would eventually go on to win the Heisman, and Baylor had its first Heisman winner ever in 2011. That is the most prestigious award in all of college football. So Robert Griffin III wins the Heisman, and all of a sudden Baylor is just like, we have a national stage now. We have the best player in college football. Things are looking great for Baylor, and everyone is excited to be there because of the football program. And then April 2012 rolls around. And there was a woman who the media has referred to as Kim, who was moving out of the dorm. And she was moving out of the dorm, and she needed some help getting a desk out of her room. So she asked around if there was any gentleman that would be willing to help her move the desk out of her dorm room. And somebody told her, oh, Tevin Elliott is around. And Tevin Elliott was a defensive end on the football team. So they found Tevin Elliott. She said, yeah, I'll be happy to help you. He walked up with her to her room, closed the door, and sexually assaulted her and raped her. And this happened, and she was shocked. She didn't know what to do with her life at that point. So shortly after this, she took her story to the ombudsman at Baylor University and said, hey, I've been assaulted by a football player. And the complaint department, the people that handle this at Baylor, the ombudsman, I can't say that word, the ombudsman department, looked at her, and they said, oh, who was it? And she said, well, it's Tevin Elliott on the football team. And they responded by saying this, you're the sixth woman to report a sexual assault by Tevin Elliott. And she said, the sixth? What happened the other five times? And they said, well, you know, it's hard to like really convict someone for something like this. And she said, well, does the football team know that he's assaulting women and that there's six allegations against him? And they responded by saying, yes, they know about it, but it turns into a he said, she said, so there's got to be actually a court decision in order to act on it in any sort of way. Which, while they said this, they didn't understand that this is actually a violation of federal law, because federal law requires all universities to conduct investigations on their own into any sexual assault allegation that happens between students. So they said these words to her, and they said, well, you know, just let's not make a big deal about this. You've almost graduated. She's like, yeah, I just want to get out of here. And like, look, we'll skip your final exams, and we'll just let you pass, and you can graduate, and you can get out of here. And she said, okay. And she got out of there. 2 weeks later, Tevin Elliott is at another party, and another woman is there. Her name is Tanya. And she is at this party, and she said that Tevin Elliott started telling her that all the friends went outside, and she's like, well, I don't want to go outside. And because Tevin Elliott's a much bigger person than she is, grabbed her by the wrist, pulled her outside, threw her into the mud, and raped her on the ground. Then she started yelling obscenities at him. He picked her up, threw her against a metal fence, raped her again, and then left the party. And Tanya didn't know what to do. Because what would you do in light of such terrible evil? So Tanya gathers herself the best she can. She calls the police and says, I've been raped. Can you do something about this? They take the report. They do everything they can. And then she goes to the school the next day, because this was a student that did this. And she reports it to the ombudsman department, and she says these words, or they say these words to her. They say, well, you're the sixth woman to report a sexual assault by Tevin Elliott. And they didn't find out until 2 years later, until the court case came through, that they were told, both these different women were told the same number. So we don't know if this was the sixth case, the seventh case, the eighth case, the ninth case. Something is strange at Baylor. And so she says, well, is there anything you can do for me? Like, I'm scared to go to classes. Can I have like an escort, like a police escort that would make sure that I'm okay between classes? And the police responded by saying, well, there's nothing we can do because the assault happened off campus. And so she went to student life and she said, hey, I've been raped by another person here at the school. Can I have a counseling appointment? And the response she got was, well, all our counselors are booked. And she said, well, is there anything you can do? And they responded by saying, well, there's no one who can see you now. You could, though, put your name on a waiting list. Maybe you should see someone off campus. And she told her mom this. Her mom called the same department, and they responded by saying to her mom, sorry, no resources are available. Even if a plane falls on your daughter, there's nothing we can do to help you. And Tevin Elliott, eventually the police report got some press on it, and once the press got hold of the story, it came to the attention of the football team, and the football team then finally, 2 weeks later after this, they suspended Tevin Elliott. And this is a tragedy, an awful thing to hear about. I mean, just terrible to even say out loud. But, you know, there's things that the university has to continue to do. So just 2 months after this, though, they broke ground on their brand new football stadium because their football team was good again, and this cost $266 million to build. They built in the summer of 2012, they started. And the stadium was being built, so they wanted things to be good, so they kept going forward with football. And this happened in the summer of 2012, but also in the summer of 2012, or just before that, during that year, that school year, the 2012 to 2013 school year, Tanya, who was there on an academic scholarship, her grades started to suffer. And because her grades started to suffer, they ended up removing her academic scholarship in the 2012-2013 school year. She dropped out and left and would later file a lawsuit, but we'll get to that in a minute. So she lost her academic scholarship. Baylor continued to build their stadium. They also found that there was this transfer player that had to drop out of Boise State. He was removed. His name was Sam Ukuwachu. And they dismissed him at Boise State, which is another football powerhouse. So who do you think picked him up right away? It was, of course, Baylor. Baylor picked this guy up. He got there in the summer. And then on October 20, 2013, Sam Ukuwachu raped a woman that the media refers to as Jane Doe. And when you hear the story that she provides, it's very graphic, it's very intense, but she described it as saying, he was using all of his strength to pull up my dress and do stuff to me, and he kept saying to me, this isn't rape. And it's just, it's awful. And she went to the police department, she went to the academic department, she did everything that she could, and she felt like nobody really cared. But things started to move slowly forward when the media started getting their hands on this story, and they started saying that something's wrong. But hey, Big 12 had just, they just won the Big 12 championship, so they didn't want a lot of distractions because this was their first Big 12 championship ever at Baylor. So they had to, you know, keep putting a good face forward for football after all. And so Baylor wins the Big 12 championship in 2013. 1 month after this picture is taken, four different women testify in court against the first assailant that we were referencing, a man named Tevin Elliott, and they convicted him, a jury convicted him for 20 years in prison. And at this point, people said, hey, does Baylor have a problem, a sexual assault problem? And Baylor kept saying, no, 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 we don't have a problem. So it's 2014, we don't have a problem in our football program. Tevin Elliott is just one case, he's just one individual. That's a bad thing, we're sorry, but that's not who we are in general. But then Baylor started their new season, they had a new stadium finally, and things were looking really good. After all, they won the Big 12 championship again, hurrah. And then shortly after this, just a few months after this picture was taken, another trial began for their other player that transferred from Boise State, Sam Ukuwachu. And they began this trial, and as the trial began, it became apparent that Baylor knew that Boise State's transfer had been kicked out for abusive issues. And so they had brought on this abusive player, and he eventually commits like this terrible rape just a few months after he gets on campus. And Baylor brought him on. Why? Because they wanted their football team to be better. And so you look at this, and you look at Joe Nocero, who wrote an opinion piece about this whole ordeal. He said, after conducting a few cursory interviews and not even asking to look at the hospital rape kit, the school cleared Ukuwachu, as his lawyer later put it. They said, we don't really find anything wrong. We'll just let the courts figure out the rest, and everything will be fine. Joe Nocero eventually said, to be blunt, Baylor seemed mainly interested in protecting its football player. So you've got all of these things happening. Ken Starr now is angry because his university is being threatened. The whole image, the brand of football, everything he's built is being threatened. So he orders a report by a third party, Pepper Hamilton, and they report to the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents releases a statement saying what they heard from this investigation by Pepper Hamilton. The report says these words: "Institutional failures at every level of Baylor's administration," which is very, very strong words, "every level of Baylor's administration directly impact the response to individual cases in the Baylor community as a whole. Football personnel affirmatively chose not to report sexual violence and dating violence to an appropriate administrator outside of athletics. Leadership challenges and communications issues hindered enforcement of rules and policies and created a cultural perception that football was above the rules." And so shortly after this report came out, Baylor finally fired Art Briles in 2016. And they also demoted Ken Starr from president to chancellor. The media was so angry about this, the students were so angry about this, that they just demoted him to a full-time law professor at Baylor. And as the story kept going, Baylor started opening up more and more what they knew, and they finally admitted just in November that they knew that 17 women reported sexual or domestic assault by 19 football players, including 4 alleged gang rapes. They knew about it for 4 years. But here's where it gets really tragic. Because in response to this statement, one of the victims, the woman referred to as Tanya, has filed a lawsuit that says actually that number's way off. There's actually 52 women who were assaulted by 31 football players between 2011 and 2014. Baylor is fighting this case and trying to get it thrown out with everything it's got. So at this point, people started asking the question, has Baylor sold its soul? This is a Christian university, remind you. Has Baylor sold its soul in order to get more football wins? And there's one guy on their board who answered a response to this question during a 60 Minutes interview, and his name was Pastor Neil Jeffrey. And in response, he said, "Well, we may have, and that's debatable, I guess, and that's why we made the changes we made. I want us to be successful in football, and right now we're 6-0. I would love to go undefeated, but not at the expense of caring for people and doing the right thing. I'd rather us be 0-6 and still fulfill our mission as a Christian university and taking care of people in the right way than to be undefeated. I'm sad for what's happened at Baylor. I'm sad that our alumni is frustrated and angry, but ultimately I'm sad for those victims, and the tragedy is what happened with those victims." And he says, "I'd rather us go 0-6, lose every game and do the right thing than be 6-0. But I have a question that I would love to ask anyone from Baylor. Why is Baylor still playing football? Like, this isn't required for accreditation, is it? You don't have to have a football team at a university. What do universities do? They educate people. So this is an extra add-on. And the minute that injustice starts to creep in, this is when the minute you say, hey, all the extra stuff needs to stop. And if 52 women alleging sexual assault isn't enough to say, hey, we should stop playing football for at least a year, then what is? And when you think about this, why is it that any university has a football team? I can only come up with 2 reasons. And the 2 reasons are this: money and school spirit. That's it. You can bring a lot of money into a university through a football program. I get it. Also, it can boost school spirit. I was part of Montana State University. You've probably never heard of us. We're a Division II school. But that school was the happiest when we beat the University of Montana. I know what it can do for school spirit. That being said, if we replace these 2 words with the same thing, which is greed and pride, isn't that what Habakkuk warned about so long ago? And Baylor has the same book that you and I have, which says, God tells us, he's like, don't live by pride, don't live by greed. Wouldn't it be great if Baylor said, hey, let's stop playing football for a year and devote all the time, energy, and money that we normally devote to football into preventing sexual assault? Because sexual assault has no place in the kingdom of God. Sexual assault doesn't belong here, and clearly, we've created some sort of culture that has allowed and fostered this, and we need to stop and get our priorities straight. Now, At this point, it's very easy for us to point the finger at Baylor, just like we point the finger at the Virginia Company and pastors from the South and at Solomon and at Joshua and say, well, good thing I'm not like them. But when you read the words of Habakkuk, and God tells him what to be worried about, when he's looking at those other nations and saying, why aren't we like Babylon? God says, look at the proud. Their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith. He goes on, he says, moreover, wealth is treacherous. The arrogant do not endure. They open their throats wide as Sheol. Like death, they have never have enough. I think the great lesson from Habakkuk in these two verses is very simple. We are all tempted by greed and pride. Every one of us. And the sin that we make is we refuse to acknowledge the greed or the pride that we have. And when you ask yourself, what does it mean to live by faith? It means to accept that we can be tempted by greed and pride, just like Habakkuk was so long ago. And we have to be aware of that because we are trying our best to grow in our faith, to grow in our understanding of God. And we trust that greed and pride won't get us ahead. We trust that the right way to live, that the way that God would have us live is a way free of greed and pride. So we acknowledge when we are greedy. We acknowledge when we are filled with pride. And we accept it. And then we do our best to transcend that greed and pride. When it comes to what does it mean to live by faith, may we all remember this. We are all tempted by greed and pride. May we live in a way that trusts that greed and pride don't run the show, that the real energy and life force and inspiration behind the universe is not greed and pride, but love and inspiration. And may we have the courage to do something about it. Amen.